Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for sharing your Friday with us. Eating disorders come in a variety of forms. Some involve restricting food, some eating extreme amounts of food. Others are defined by a cycle between overeating and then getting rid of food through vomiting, using laxatives, or over-exercising. According to the National Eating Disorders Association, 20 million women and 10 million men in the United States suffer from a clinically significant eating disorder at some point in their lives. And while anorexia nervosa, in which people believe they are overweight when they've actually dropped to an abnormally low body weight, affects only 0.6% of the U.S. population, it is the deadliest mental illness. The National Institutes of Health reports that anorexia has an estimated mortality rate of around 10%. In this hour, we'll be discussing the brain, eating disorders, and the emerging science of mindfulness with psychiatrist Dr. Harry Brandt. How do eating disorders affect the brain? What role do genetics play? And can practicing mindfulness, concentrated relaxation, help people recover? Dr. Harry Brandt is co-director of the Center for Eating Disorders at Sheppard Pratt. He's also chief of psychiatry at University of Maryland St. Joseph Medical Center. Dr. Brandt has studied and treated people with eating disorders for more than two decades, and he previously served as director of the Eating Disorders Program at the National Institutes of Health. Welcome to Midday. Welcome back to Midday.
Pleasure to be here, Sheila.
How common are eating disorders?
Well, they're very common, and some of the statistics are a bit misleading. I thought your lead-in was excellent, and it really highlighted how severe the eating disorders can be. But there are many, many individuals who don't meet all of the classical criteria of an eating disorder. So they have most of the features of anorexia nervosa, but don't have the entire syndrome. So they might fall out of those statistics. So generally, a half to 2% is cited for anorexia nervosa, depending on how strict the diagnostic criteria are applied. But it's the, as you mentioned, the deadliest of psychiatric illnesses, and we lose patients to this illness every year. And the other eating disorders are very severe as well.
Are they more widespread? Are there more cases of bulimia?
There are. Bulimia affects about 5% of populations at risk, so it's several times more common than anorexia nervosa. Complicating matters is that about half of individuals who have anorexia nervosa are also binging and purging, so they have characteristics of the related illness, bulimia nervosa.
Right. These terms will probably come up. So, what is the difference between anorexia nervosa and bulimia?
Well, as you mentioned, anorexia nervosa is an illness characterized by a self-imposed starvation. So, the patient is by necessity very thin, despite being at a very, very low weight, significantly below what a normal person would be at. They have a body image distortion where they actually view and experience their body as too large, and this drives further weight loss. And because of the starvation, they develop a whole range of physical abnormalities and difficulties.
Such as?
Every major organ system in the body can be affected by starvation. So they may have cardiac problems. They may have a whole range of abnormalities in their blood in terms of the elements in blood that are maintained called electrolytes. They have body wasting. They can develop osteoporosis, hypoglycemia. Just many, many different organ systems are affected by not getting the nutrition that the body needs.
And how do eating disorders affect the brain?
Well, the brain, we're born with a brain that has certain temperaments that may predispose to eating disorders. For example, the temperament of something called harm avoidance, which is a fear of the adverse consequences potential in the world. Kids are born with, if you saw two toddlers at the beach, one might run into the water and just be very excited about that, and another might be very afraid of what would happen and be afraid to even put his or her toe in the water. And those are really inborn temperaments that have now been shown to be genetic to some extent. And eating disorders have been shown to emerge in people with certain temperaments. So anorexia has sorted with perfectionism. That is, people who like to have things just so, and a certain symmetry and a certain need for perfection. And harm avoidance, those two temperaments are very common in anorexia nervosa. So right from the start of life, the brain probably is having an influence on who has a vulnerability to develop an eating disorder. And then there are areas of the brain that are very involved in hunger and fullness feelings. In other words, when we eat our lunches today, at first we're very hungry, and that's because certain brain regions are letting us know it's time to eat, and they're firing. The insula is an area of the brain that's very important in terms of that. These systems may go somewhat haywire in people with anorexia nervosa. There's an area at the base of the brain called the hypothalamus that controls a lot of involuntary functions in the body, and it's very involved in regulation of hunger and fullness. So an area called the lateral hypothalamus is a hunger area. When that lateral hypothalamus fires, often people are very hungry, and if a scientist were to ablate that area of the brain in a non-human primate or a rodent,
cut it out, or
use an electrode to damage the neurons in that area,
so that it wouldn't function correct,
that animal might then starve itself to death. So that,
because it would just lose interest, it would not ever tell itself it was hungry. It would not ever perceive itself to be hungry.
Correct. It wouldn't have appetitive hunger sensations, and it would avoid eating, and it would starve. Similarly, there's another area in the hypothalamus called the ventromedial hypothalamus that's involved in fullness feelings. And if that same scientist decided he was going to go in with his electrode and ablate that area of the brain, the animal might eat voraciously and keep eating and getting larger and larger and larger, because despite the eating behavior, there's not a turning off of the eating behavior. Now, I'm simplifying this a little bit. There are many, many areas of the brain that are involved in hunger and fullness, but that would be an important area. And this area, the hypothalamus, is involved in lots of the functions that seem to be disturbed in anorexia nervosa. So it's been a area of active investigation.
And so, I mean, you just described two attitudes toward eating that seemed to kind of match anorexia or bulimia.
Yeah, I was doing that on purpose because it's kind of interesting to do that, to think about how these animal models might fit with these eating disorders that we see. So I'll give you another one, too. There's an area in the brain called the insula. You have a question. Go ahead.
No.
Okay. There's an area of the brain that's called the insula, and there have been some studies now that have shown the insula gets real if you fed somebody a piece of cake that they were very interested in. As they began to look at it, the insula would become very, very active. It seems that, and when they ate some of that cake and the sugar was on their tongue, the insula would really be firing. And then as they ate the cake, you would see a decrease in the firing in that area of the brain. And in patients with anorexia nervosa, in very carefully done studies, elegant studies with something called fMRI, this area of the brain's been studied. And in anorexic patients, that area of the brain seems less active. That is, that you don't see as much of a rise and fall in the activity of the insula when palatable food is presented to an anorexic patient relative to a healthy volunteer. So scientists are actively studying the reward centers of the brain. For some reason, food is not particularly rewarding like it is to a healthy person. Most of us, yes. Most of us, you know, look forward to eating. And I'm a bit of a foodie myself. I look forward to eating. And then as I eat and I get full and satiated, you know, then I'm not as interested. But it doesn't work that way for the person with anorexia nervosa.
That's Dr. Harry Brandt, co-director of the Center for Eating Disorders at Sheppard Pratt. Here on Midday on WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about eating disorders and what effect the brain has on them or what effect they have on the brain. If this is a question that has interested you or if you have any other question about eating disorders, it's a good time to call us. 410-662-8780 is our local number, 410-662-8780. Or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. And that, Dr. Brandt, is what I'm still curious about, is when you describe looking at the insula of someone with anorexia and can see that it's just not as active as it is with, in a normal person, a healthy person. Is that something that the disorder has trained that brain to be and changed the shape of that brain, or is that something that preexisted?
Well, Sheila, you're getting at what is, I think, the most interesting area of anorexia research, and this has been the quagmire of anorexia research, and I've been doing this for a long time, and that is, what are results of starvation? What brain abnormalities develop because a person has starved themselves down to a dangerously low weight versus what might have been a trait abnormality that was there at the outset that led them to develop an eating disorder? There's been a ton of work done to try to ferret out the complexity of this. And the way studies have been designed, and this goes back to when I was at the NIH in the 1980s, is that patients are studied at low weight, and then after a period of refeeding when they've gotten back to a normal weight. So then we try to understand, well, what corrected itself with adequate nutrition versus what might be a trait abnormality that persist. And some of those abnormalities I mentioned, the insula in particular, seems to persist in weight-recovered patients. And we see some patients who, some of the temperament aspects, the perfectionism, the harm avoidance, their obsessionality around food and eating behavior seems to persist after weight recovery, which makes the disorder very difficult to treat.
And someone who tends to binge eat, are the reward centers of their brain sort of overactive? Do they get more reward or do they get less, and that's why they keep searching for more by eating more?
Well, yes. I think there are clearly in bulimia nervosa where a person eats and eats with a tremendous velocity, more than many of us would eat in a whole day, and doesn't feel particularly satiated from it, and then feel so engorged that they might choose to engage in a counteractive measure like vomiting or compulsive exercise or starvation to reverse the impact of those calories. Yes, there are certainly abnormalities in brain systems. There's been a lot of genetic work also that bears upon this. The serotonin system in brain, which serotonin being one of the neurotransmitters that's been very actively studied in depression and other mental illnesses, is also one of the neurotransmitters that you would read about if you did a survey of the animal literature on feeding behavior. So we have these neurotransmitters active in brain that are very involved in regulating our eating behavior. And abnormalities in the serotonin system have been highlighted in bulimia nervosa as well. So yeah, there's a lot of there are a lot of different lines of evidence that are suggesting that the eating disorders are biological entities. And I think that's really important because we used to over-focus on the sociocultural aspect of the illness. That is that, we live in a society that emphasizes the importance of thinness to be considered successful and attractive, and we see skinny runway models, and at the same time that we have rapid availability to fast food. So there certainly are these sociocultural aspects, but this is a disorder that has, these disorders have roots in brain and brain metabolism.
Well, we're going to keep talking about that. We need to take a short break now. We're going to continue with Dr. Harry Brandt, co-director of the Center for Eating Disorders at Sheppard Pratt. He's also chief of psychiatry at University of Maryland St. Joseph Medical Center. And as I said, you can be part of this conversation. Have you or a loved one sought treatment for an eating disorder? You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780. A few folks already have, and we'll talk to them after this quick break. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about eating disorders, the brain, and how the practice of mindfulness can aid people in recovery. With me here in Studio A is Dr. Harry Brandt. He's co-director of the Center for Eating Disorders at Sheppard Pratt, and he's chief of psychiatry at University of Maryland St. Joseph Medical Center. And you can be part of this conversation. Our local number is 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Bob has called us from Baltimore. Bob, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure. Your question?
My wife experiences a range of eating disorders that include anorexia, bulimia, and some other behaviors. It's been recommended to her by a few different psychiatrists that she go to an inpatient facility like the one at Sheppard Pratt. She's extremely reluctant to do so because I think she's concerned about the loss of personal liberty, that she's going to be effectively locked up and, forced to eat things that she doesn't want to eat. And I was wondering if you could speak to two things. One would be inpatient treatment and what that's like and what someone like my wife, who's very reluctant to do so, might need to know to be willing to go. And also what I, as a loved one, can do with someone who has a severe and dangerous illness of this type, and it can be very hard to help with.
Bob, I appreciate the call.
Bob, those are great questions, and they're questions we get a lot. First of all, let me just say that I think really it's your wife's illness that would lock her up as opposed to, going to a place where she would begin to get help. In terms of what happens in inpatient care is designed for somebody who's not able to take steps on their own to begin to neutralize what is a very dangerous and debilitating disorder. So we can't just reproduce what's going on for your wife, say, in the outside world on our unit. So we would be encouraging her to take the risk to her associated with beginning to eat more normally. But associated with that are a tremendous number of therapies on our unit to help a person deal with the crisis that creates for them. So, she would be encouraged to eat. She wouldn't be forced to eat. She would be encouraged to try to take the first steps towards recovering from a disorder that could have life-threatening impact on her. So I don't tend to think of it as, we're locking somebody up. In fact, all the patients on our unit at Sheppard Pratt are voluntary patients, but many struggle with eating. There's a ton of support that she would get to begin to take the first steps towards eating more normally, because she's probably really afraid of eating. It's probably for her like it would be for me getting thrown out of an airplane with a parachute, since I've never done that before. Presumably if somebody encouraged me to try that, I'd still be pretty scared. But, with the right training and support and help, who knows? Maybe I could get somewhere.
Bob asked what loved ones can do.
Yeah, there's a lot a loved one can do. First is just continuing to encourage your wife to get the help she needs, which it sounds like you already are. And also, we have free support groups for patients and family members. So somebody who's afraid to take the plunge into getting the help they need might want to start by just coming to one of our free support groups at Sheppard Pratt. And you can get a lot of information from our website at www.eatingdisorder.org.
We will link to that.
Both about the illnesses and about the treatments we provide. One thing that's happened over the last decades in terms of treatment, Bob, that I think is really important is that the treatment is much less imposed on the patient than it used to be. I mean, 30 years ago when we started treating eating disorders, it was a little bit more paternalistic. Now it's more collaborative. Dr. Janet Treasure in England has been a pioneer of something called a collaborative care model. And that's that's our mindset, which is that we would want to collaborate with your wife. We wouldn't want to force anything upon her, because we know that if we forced weight on your wife in the hospital, when she leaves the hospital, she's just going to go back to starving herself down to a low weight again. But if we're able to collaborate with her and help her interpersonally understand more about why she's so afraid of eating and all the deleterious effects that's having on not just her body, but also probably on relationships, and it's probably a struggle. I think she could really get somewhere.
Bob, thank you so much for the call. One thing you mentioned earlier, Dr. Brandt, that I wanted to follow up on is people's vision of themselves, their view that of their body, that it's too big and it ought to be restrained. Is that rooted in the brain? And if so, how?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's one of the symptoms of anorexia that really drew me into being so intrigued with the disorder. And that is that as a person loses weight, they have this distortion of body image, the C criteria of the DSM the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Eating Disorders we were talking earlier about. And that is the body image distortion that a person feels much larger than they really are. They feel fat rolling on their body even though they're emaciated, and they have this distortion. When I first started working with the illness, I thought they were just kind of pulling my leg on that, and the reality was that they were afraid of eating, maybe. So they were saying, well, I feel too fat. But when you meet and work with these patients, you begin to see that they actually do have this distortion. And there's been a lot of work in understanding that illusion, if you will, in brain, the parietal cortex and the temporal cortex and the occipital cortex and various projections that may be functioning abnormally in the starvation state that lead to that. And as I mentioned earlier, there are some persisting aspects, and often when a person has gained to a normal weight, they will continue to feel grossly obese for a span of time. But something that is also very interesting is that sometimes, you know, as a person gains weight and begins the recovery process, the body image distortion begins to decrease, so they'll feel less fat after they're eating more normally than they were when they were down at a dangerously low weight, which I think has always been very, very interesting.
So is there a particular place in the brain where this cross signal happens, where someone perceives themselves as big when they're small?
Well, the way that's been studied is with, again, PET scan and functional MRI, where people are shown images of themselves and others at various weights, and there are a number of brain areas that light up. And, you know, the problem is that that's a very complex phenomenon, how we experience ourselves, our so-called interoceptive awareness, how we experience our body size from within. And so there are a number of brain areas that are involved in that, including the prefrontal cortex, the occipital cortex, which is very involved in vision and visual stimuli.
Uh-huh. That would make sense. This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Kest. Here with me is the co-director of Shepherd Pratt's Center for Eating Disorders, Dr. Harry Brandt. And I'd like to pull somebody else into the conversation now. Joining us by phone is Carolyn LaBrie. She's co-president of the Eating Disorder Network of Maryland. It's a nonprofit that holds awareness events and provides information about local specialists. She is a psychologist who specializes in eating disorder treatment at Prosperity Eating Disorders and Wellness in Herndon, Virginia. And Carolyn LaBrie has experienced what it's like to seek treatment for an eating disorder. She was diagnosed with anorexia nervosa when she was 15. Carolyn LaBrie, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us briefly a bit of your story.
Okay, sure. Well, I was diagnosed with anorexia at 15. I really kind of came into the illness. It was kind of a long time coming, I guess, looking back. There were a lot of things going on in my life, and there were a lot of triggers for me, and that's how it ultimately ended up manifesting. Back then, there were fewer options for treatment, and my family didn't have insurance coverage for the higher levels of care that I needed at the time. And so I ended up doing outpatient treatment for a very long time. I was weekly seeing a psychologist and a psychiatrist and a dietitian and going through it that way. And I would make some gains, and then things would happen, and I would fall back and relapse. And that went on for really all of high school and into some of my college years as well. And I really didn't thrive too well with the more traditional treatments. And so I eventually, if I really wanted to pull myself out of it and have a life, I needed to kind of try to find some other ways to deal with not only the eating disorder, but also the underlying anxieties that I had and kind of the root issues of the problem that had been identified throughout my treatment process, but been resolved.
How did you, I mean, it sounds to me like you were kind of at a stalemate. How did you break through that?
Well, I had a day in particular, and I was in the middle of a relapse, and I was very, very sick, very underweight. And I could feel in my body that I wasn't really going to be around much longer. Mm. I can't describe it any other way. I just knew that I was going to die if I didn't do something about it. And ultimately, the decision that I made was, you know, nothing in my life that's been troubling me has changed as a result of me holding on to this illness. And so maybe I should try something different.
And what did you try?
Maybe, I just decided to actually try to get well, where I had in spurts here and there throughout my treatment, but I also spent a lot of time trying to trick my providers into thinking that I was getting better when I actually wasn't. And I kind of just, I would do what I needed to do to stay in sports, maybe, or to do something that I wanted to do that was kind of being used as leverage to try to get me to do what I needed to do.
So what changed for you?
I didn't want to die.
No, I understand that.
Yeah,
but once you decided that, what did you do differently?
I came clean with my treatment team, and I said, you know, look, there's some things that I've been not 100% honest about, and I've kind of made the decision that I don't see any other way but to go forward in a more positive direction than I've been doing. And they were very nice about it and very supportive. And from that point on, I just had to step through the fear every single day. And it wasn't easy. It wasn't like all smooth sailing by any means. But I just made a decision every day. I remembered that moment that I had that I felt like if I don't do something different, I'm not going to have a life anymore. And that had scared me so much, and I remembered that fear, and I remembered that I didn't want to die, and I just reminded myself of that every day.
And what role did meditation play in your being able to hang on to that clarity?
Meditation?
Meditation.
I had a lot of anxiety, profound anxiety, and that had been something that was present in me ever since I was a child. And I had tried medication, and I had tried, cognitive behavioral therapy and kind of the traditional ways to deal with that, and none of that had really worked. And so people had always encouraged me, you know, maybe you should try yoga, maybe you should try meditation, and I would always say, no way, I'm way too anxious to just sit still for 20 or 30 minutes and not do anything. But I decided to try it one day, and there's not been anything that's worked more for me than the meditation for the anxiety piece. And as soon as I started to notice a decrease in my anxiety levels and a way that I could be more present every day, because I was always this what if. I was always like 12 steps ahead of myself thinking, you know, anticipating outcomes of things where you know, that's never actually what happens. Whatever you put, you know, make up in your mind is never usually what actually occurs. But I was always in that place of the future, always what if thinking, and that was just perpetuating the anxiety even more. And once I started to meditate, I learned that I was able to find peace by bringing myself back to the present moment. So, for example, you know, 15 years ago, I would be having a conversation with you, but I wouldn't actually be present.
In the conversation.
Exactly. I could have the conversation, but I would be thinking in my mind of all the million things I had to do, you know, 3 hours from now or 3 days from now, and I would be shaking and trembling and sweating and having on the edge of a panic attack.
Dr. Brand, a lot of people are talking about mindfulness these days. How do you define it?
Well, mindfulness is really a momentary, a minute-to-minute evaluation. It's getting into a mindset where a person is very focused on their breathing with relaxation. And interestingly, it correlates with some brain issues that we can get into. But a person in the here and now has a momentary awareness of themselves or something they focus on. Breathing is common, an object, a mantra. And the mind is moving into a non-judgmental state where a state of deep relaxation comes in. And this has been shown to be very, very effective and helpful in lots of treatments. There have been treatments that have emerged that are very useful in eating disorders now, something called dialectical behavioral treatment.
And let's hold that thought until we're going to take another break.
Sure.
Right here. And I want to hear more from both of you about this. Dr. Harry Brandt, co-director of the Center for Eating Disorders at Shepherd Pratt, and Carolyn Labrie, who suffered from anorexia throughout high school and college and now works with patients with eating disorders. Have you used mindfulness in order to address stress, anxiety, or an eating disorder? Do you have meditation apps on your phone? If you've got some thoughts about this, join the conversation, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. We'll be back after a quick break. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. We're talking about eating disorders this hour with Dr. Harry Brandt, co-director of the Center for Eating Disorders at Shepherd Pratt, and psychologist Carolyn Labrie, who is co-president of the Eating Disorder Network of Maryland. We've been talking about the role of the brain in all this, and meditation and mindfulness. Marianne from Bel Air has a question that may fit into this. Marianne, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I was a compulsive overeater for years and years, and in my 40s became morbidly obese, was never overweight until my mid-30s, and had bariatric surgery, lost a lot of weight. Within 2 months after the surgery, I developed alcoholism. And so one of my questions is the correlate. Number one, obesity and compulsive overeating, is there's not much treatment for it, not in terms of psychological applications. And also, I learned in my recovery that there's a lot of cross addiction. That behavior, unless you're really diligent, it transfers from one thing to another. And then the last comment I want to make, and that's since I've heard you all talking about this, that mindfulness was my answer. Ultimately, it's still extremely challenging. I went to a retreat. I've read books and years of therapy. This most recent experience with learning mindfulness and meditation, and also going to Al-Anon, quite honestly, to help with that self-care end of it. And feeling like I can take care of myself, and I have to do that before I can take care of anyone else. So those are my comments. And I'm just with the rampant obesity in our society, I just know that's an addiction. And so if you could address that too, I'd appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Marianne, thanks for the call. So Dr. Brand, how does addiction fit into what we've been talking about? Are eating disorders addictions?
Well, that's a common topic at professional meetings a lot, which is, you know, how do the eating disorders fit in with addictive behaviors? And clearly there's some commonality, particularly with compulsive overeating and binge behavior. There's patients describe that they feel very hooked on the behavior, that it's meeting an emotional need, some of the same kinds of things you'd hear about from somebody struggling with alcohol or substance abuse. I was interested in the symptom substitution issue there, that the caller was describing that she seemed to get the compulsive overeating under control, but then that the problem seemed to morph towards alcohol. And it begs the question, is there some underlying issue that was being dealt with through eating behavior that then now is being dealt with another potentially very unhealthy behavior of overuse of alcohol? So there clearly is a relationship. One issue is that in treatment of substance use disorders and alcoholism, the treatment of choice is abstinence, but we all need to continue to eat food every day, so we're confronted with the stimuli for the disorder, makes treatment a bit more complex than in just an abstinence model.
It does sound complex. Carolyn LaBrie, what goes through your mind when you hear all the issues that she put on the table?
I actually first thought that I could relate, different manifestation of the illness, obviously, but I did find at times that when my eating disorder would kind of take a back burner and I would start to kind of recover in some way from that there would be other kinds of compulsions that would crop up for me. As Dr. Brandt was saying, perhaps indicating that there was more going on than had been dealt with. And so that need to kind of comfort, I guess for me it was some form of comfort, was still there. And it was too anxiety producing sometimes to not have anything.
And is that the situation where you found mindfulness
ultimately
important?
Yes, definitely. Because I think something that meditation has done for me that I never was able to do in my life, it allowed me to be still and actually feel feelings and see the kinds of thoughts that I was having, because I always found that my mind was racing and that my thoughts would race. Certainly with the eating disorder, there were very clear, loud eating disordered thoughts that were directing me, to not eat or to engage in other behaviors. But beyond that, the rest of my thoughts just seemed to be jumbled, and I never could always really get a handle on them. And so being able to sit through that, which was something I was terrified to do, brought me a lot of confidence in my ability to deal with pain and to deal with the things that were lying underneath the illness that I hadn't always been able to get to because I was always engaged in something else and not allowing myself to feel.
That's Carolyn. That's Carolyn LaBrie here on Midday on WYPR. She is a psychologist who treats patients with eating disorders she herself suffered through anorexia. Also here in the studio with me is Dr. Harry Brandt, co-director of the Center for Eating Disorders at Shepherd Pratt. We got an email from Diane asking what parents can do for small children who are displaying avoidant behavior, avoiding food.
Well, early treatment is really important. So if one were to notice that their child was avoiding food, it would be very important to try to understand where that's coming from. What is their fear about eating? There's a disorder more recently defined called ARFID, avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, that it really stems from kids struggling with the sensory aspects of eating. There's something about food in their certain foods and food in their mouth that bothers them, and or they may have other fears associated with eating, fear of swallowing or fear of choking, or they may be beginning to show signs of development of a more common or typical eating disorder like anorexia nervosa. We're seeing younger and younger kids developing fear of fatness, fear of eating, having a whole range of problems, and early treatment is very important. So I think if one notices an ongoing pattern, they should get help. I'd have to counter that also by saying that there are some kids who are just finicky eaters early on, and they will ultimately outgrow that. It's very hard to know, and that's where getting professional help is important.
Kimberly is calling us from Baltimore. Welcome to Midday, Kimberly.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm really enjoying the show. And I am someone who had bulimia as a teenager. My mother also had bulimia, so I think I learned it at home. It was, you know, socialized and taught to me. Maybe it was, you know, brain chemistry. But I was helped by a psychotherapist over like 10 years who helped me, and without any drugs or anything, medications, and she had told me that it's possible that psychotherapy can change your brain chemistry. And I just wanted to ask you about your thoughts on that, Dr. Brandt.
Absolutely. I think studies have borne that out, that, the reality is that the brain has an effect on behavior, but behavior has effects on the brain. And yes, I think, and particularly in the future when we have more sensitive ways to measure neuronal systems and neuronal patterns and neurotransmitter function, we're going to find out that, people, when they get into a mindfulness state, for example, that there's a certain pattern emerging in the brain, and that when people have psychotherapy for years and years and change behavior, that they're laying down new pathways in brain, or changing existing pathways, or changing modulating neurotransmitter function. So yes, I would agree with your therapist that that the work that you did modifying your bulimic behaviors probably created some changes in brain.
Kimberly, thank you for the call. Carolyn LeBrie, what does meditation look like in your life now? How often do you do it? Where? When?
So I actually have a meditation app on my phone. It's called Insight Timer, and it's a timer, literally. You can set it for as long as you want, and there's also some guided meditations on there. So I have a handful that I go to every now and then. But essentially, 10 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes before I go to bed, I meditate. And there's this little room in my house that I didn't know what else to do with, and I made that my little meditation room. And I have a corner bookshelf that has some nice things that bring me joy and peace on it. And I have my little cushion, and I burn some incense, and I will just sit.
Can I ask
do that,
Carolyn,
for 20 minutes a day?
Carolyn, it's Dr. Brandt. I have a question for you. Do you think that by practicing meditation the way you do in the morning and the evening, mm-hmm. sets the stage for you at other times in the day to drift into a mindful state, even for a brief period of time, that helps you? Do you think your work with meditation is limited to those times that you set aside?
No, it absolutely carries into the day, and actually that's been one of the great things and really the reason that I've scheduled the meditation sessions the way I have is because in the morning, as I'm sitting, I'm able to kind of set the intention mm-hmm. to have peace mm-hmm. and to return to that part of me that is peaceful and calm throughout the day mm-hmm. when things get stressful. And then at night, you know, before I go to bed and I'm sitting for 10 minutes, my intention is to release myself of any negativity that's come along during the day so that I can go to bed and actually fall asleep instead of lying there with my mind going mm-hmm. as it used to do. Mm-hmm. So it absolutely, it has made, I mean, I wish I hadn't waited so long to try it because I would have had a lot of an easier time earlier in my life if I had done this sooner. But it's really been a godsend for me.
We have just 2 minutes left, but Laura in Baltimore is raising an important question. Laura, can you make your point briefly?
Yes. I am a DBT therapist in Baltimore in an inpatient unit, and I've noticed that almost none of my African-American clients have an eating disorder or have any body image issues. These are all adolescents, and a lot of my Caucasian clients do. So I'm wondering about the nature-nurture part of it.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you, Laura, for teeing that up. Dr. Brandt or Carolyn, either one?
It may be that you're not seeing as many African-American individuals with eating disorders, but we do see actually a fair number, and some research has suggested that rates of eating disorders in African-American populations is actually on the rise. So, I think it may be a bit of an outlier that you're not seeing any in your teenage patients.
I wish we had more time to pursue this. We have more folks who want to be part of this conversation. It obviously is something people care a great deal about. I really want to thank you, Dr. Harry Brandt, co-director of the Center for Eating Disorders at Shepherd Pratt. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Carolyn LaBrie, co-president of the Eating Disorder Network of Maryland, a psychologist who specializes in eating disorder treatment at Prosperity Eating Disorders and Wellness in Herndon, Virginia. Thank you for taking time to talk to us.
Thank you for having me.
I'd also like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. And thank you for listening. National Eating Disorders Awareness Week takes place week after next, February 21st to 27th. The Center for Eating Disorders at Shepherd Pratt is hosting a couple of free community events, one on Sunday the 21st, Adventures in Self-Care, and also a mindfulness workshop on Thursday the 25th. Pre-registration is required. Check out we'll link to their website on our website so you can learn more about them. Thank you for listening. Tune in Monday. We'll be speaking with Democratic candidate for Mayor DeRay McKesson. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.